Bankruptcy law may not be kryptonite to ward off lawsuits over allegedly harmful products. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. A federal appeals court has struck down an effort by Johnson & Johnson to use bankruptcy law to parry thousands of lawsuits over its talc-based powder products. The decision affects a relatively new legal strategy. Marketplace's Nova Safo is here with more.
And David, this strategy is known by lawyers as the Texas two-step. Here's how it works. A company splits itself up, keeps most of its assets, and puts its civil liabilities in a spinoff. That spinoff then declares bankruptcy to consolidate and negotiate a single settlement for all the lawsuits it faces. This process is legal under Texas law, and it is what Johnson & Johnson did. It created a separate company, put talc lawsuits in it, thousands of cases, and then declared bankruptcy.
And this appeals court ruling said J&J cannot use the two-step. Why?
Well, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia said that what Johnson & Johnson did is not a legitimate use of the bankruptcy process because the company was not in financial distress. We spoke with Carl Tobias, a law professor at the University of Richmond, about the potential implications here.
This ruling is so clear and so convincing that it may cut off further use of the Texas two-step, which is a positive thing for people who believe they've been harmed, either on the one hand by opioids or by the alleged problems with talc and other consumer products.
Now, Tobias mentioned opioids there. That relates to Purdue Pharma, which declared bankruptcy and negotiated a big settlement. That case has some important differences compared to Johnson & Johnson, but it does go to show the breadth of the potential impact of this ruling that it could have on more cases down the line.
All right, Nova, thank you. And this economic forecast won't seem like good news, but it's being taken as a positive sign. The International Monetary Fund said overnight that global economic growth will slow this year to just under 3%, but it'll rise to slightly over 3% next year. Thing is, that's better than it calculated last fall, implying some improvement as inflation recedes some. Today marks 3 years since Britain's official exit from the European Union, and President Biden is putting pressure on London and Brussels to settle a disagreement over the rules that govern trade between Ireland and Northern Ireland. After the UK left the EU, a system was set up to allow goods to flow across the Irish land border without checks. Here's the BBC's John Campbell.
The White House is very, very interested in this because they have made clear that they think that the protocol, as imperfect as it is, does the job of keeping this Irish border open and that the UK should not act unilaterally to override the protocol. And basically, the White House have made clear it would not be good for US-UK relations if that was to happen. Now, at one stage, the UK was keen on trying to get a trade deal with the United States as a potential Brexit bonus. I think the White House has been pretty clear that they're not really very interested in doing trade deals with anybody at the moment. So that removes a little bit of leverage. But nonetheless, the White House is keeping a close eye on this.
That's John Campbell, BBC. Now to what you might call the slow photography movement. A few years ago, when I rode bicycle from San Francisco to Los Angeles with about 2,000 other people, most of them brought camera phones to spray every scene. I guess just to be different, I brought an old school black and white film camera, which added a pound and a half to everything, but I felt the results were worth it. Now Gen Zers are riffing on this by opting to use digital cameras, often older than they are, which from a technical point of view are awful compared to the cameras and the phones they have already. For more, let's turn to David Little. He's the executive director at the International Center of Photography based in New York. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you make of this trend toward often younger people using crummy old digital cameras?
Well, I think there's something about the allure of something that might be a little bit more retro or old. And I think whether it's older digital or analog cameras, it kind of indicates that they're a little bit bored with perfection.
A modern smartphone camera does amazing things. It can take pictures in extraordinarily low light. So much is in focus. And you think that's maybe sometimes getting a little boring?
It is. It's too easy. And like, what does it mean to see an image that looks exactly like you think it looks? There's somewhat of an assumption that we see things as individuals all the same way in these images. And maybe one could say, particularly with analog, is that with analog pictures or with these older technologies, the individuals who are creating those images are actually creating images that are more in tune with what they see.
Just before we connected here, I was browsing some of the photographs of one of the great photographers, Alfred Stieglitz. And you know, these are great photographs, often of New York. But I started to see it. In some of these pictures, Stieglitz pictures, look a bit like something you might get on a crummy point-and-shoot from 1999 rather than what comes off your fancy phone.
Precisely. And it's really roughly, let's say, from the late 19th century to early 20th century that we start to get this notion of a kind of what we might see as a clear or pristine image that is so much like the pristine images that we have today. But you're absolutely right. There is more of that kind of point-and-shoot rough, again, personalized quality. One of the distinctions of that period, which is a little bit different from today, is that at that time, Stieglitz and many of the photographers were thinking about photography in competition with painting. So they thought that it was necessary to blur, that photographs would be like an impressionist painting. And maybe we could say that about the teens today. They want to have ownership of their own image making and their own creativity, much like Stieglitz and that first generation of great photographers.
David Little, Executive Director at the International Center for Photography. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Of course, one of my super pro photojournalist pals does like to remind me of the rule, the best camera is the one you have with you. Our producers are Katie Barnfield, James Graham, Ariana Rosas, Alex Schroeder, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. We are from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.